to sing songs, it'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down, for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KABU.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
Cascadia. Today is Friday, May 22nd, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Our guest today, Aaron Corvin, investigative reporter and journalist with the Columbia newspaper out of Vancouver. Aaron will take us behind the wall of secrecy and into the Port of Vancouver's oil terminal negotiations with Tesoro and Savage, if you can even dignify what happened with the term negotiations, because it appears that it's a done deal without the without any public oversight whatsoever. Washington, in fact, does have an Open Public Meetings Act. It's intended to ensure that the deliberations and actions of public bodies are conducted openly. This did not happen. Aaron Corvin and Eric Flora at the Columbian have researched this and investigated it. I'm going to put links to the work on the KBOO website. It's something you've got to read, because the idea of an oil terminal in Vancouver, however how horrific this is to many people in the environmental community, what should really concern us is the secrecy under which this whole deal was put together. That should be alarming, because that has greater and deeper implications for what we call a free society. Joining us this morning, we are very happy to welcome Aaron Corvin. Thanks for being with us today, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, what you've done is really extraordinary. Because of the incredible secrecy under which negotiations were conducted, Tesoro and Savage have taken us a long way down the path towards an oil handling operation involving the Port of Portland site. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the story, some of the names involved, some of the key players, and basically how we got from a relatively secure port facility handling all manner of cargo on a daily basis to this staggeringly inappropriate use of the Columbia Rivers in light of all of the accidents that have happened. It seems that a day does not go by without some accident involving fossil fuels. So could you just take our listeners through this and how you got started looking into it?
Sure, absolutely. The issue of secrecy surrounding the how the Port of Vancouver handled the decision-making process on what really would be the nation's largest oil by rail transfer terminal here. It really goes back to, or intensified in July of 2013, and there was a public meeting held on the eve of what was expected to be a vote to approve the lease with Tesoro and Savage. That public meeting was held on July 22nd, what happened was the Port of Vancouver commissioners went into what's called an executive session, a closed-door executive session where the public was excluded. And documents that I obtained in the series of stories I've worked on showed that indicate that commissioners discussed public testimony during that closed-door session, which is not allowed under Washington State's Sunshine Laws. At that time, I wrote about that, a front-page story about that, questioning the legality of that closed-door session. Subsequently, at least a few months later, a lawsuit was filed against the Port of Vancouver by three environmental groups alleging that the port had violated the Washington State's Open Public Meetings Act. And from that lawsuit, it's been going on now for well over a year, depositions were taken, court depositions were taken of the three commissioners, because the judge in that case allowed some pretrial discovery to occur, which led to court depositions being taken of the commissioners. Those depositions were filed publicly. And as I was following up about the ports, the issues with the ports handling of the oil terminal lease, I read hundreds of pages of court depositions and also had, through public disclosure requests, obtained additional documents. And so really what we did was what started as a single story that ended up becoming a lawsuit then became the series of stories that we did about the port's insular handling of this oil terminal lease decision. And there have been some other issues with the port in terms of information it's withheld from the public that hasn't been linked directly to the oil terminal, although I would say that the series we did, significant parts of it really dealt with the port's handling of the oil terminal lease, and showed that, for example, an exclusivity agreement had been reached to negotiate with Tesoro and Savage before the public had even heard a single word about it.
And, the safety issues here, one reason for the secrecy is so if the public got wind of what was being planned, and it was revealed that, as you write, since 2006, the U.S. and Canada have seen at least 24, and these would be major, because there have been so many minor incidents as well. I believe they only count ones in which there was significant cleanup was required, that does not include accidents in which the authorities decided that it was not of any concern as far as health, safety, environmental issues. But the 24 oil train accidents involving fire, derailment, significant amount of fuel spilled. And that's just coming from the Associated Press. I took a look, and outlets, media outlets such as Earth First find more, so do Sierra Club and others like that. There was a terrible derailment of an oil train on May 6 in rural North Dakota, and that was the fifth one involving a big fire this year. So the response to the safety concerns, what has Inslee, Jay Inslee, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, done about this? Has Washington State government had, what has been your experience of state government's involvement?
Absolutely. State government has been involved quite significantly. There were, during the current legislative session, there were two bills. They were basically competing bills. One was backed by Governor Inslee. And really what happened, and they both were attempting to get at the heart of what the state could do in terms of the transportation of oil by rail, in terms of boosting safety. And you know, what happened is essentially is that the bill that was backed by the governor, he got some of what he wanted, and a competing bill, they got some of what they wanted. There was essentially a compromise. And what I can tell you, a couple upshots of that bill that was signed into law by the governor recently. For example, one major component of that is to require railroads to show or demonstrate to state authorities that it has the wherewithal to clean up potential oil spills. So that's new from the state's perspective. And my understanding also is that there was an expansion of a tax on the barrel of oil to include transportation of oil by rail, and that those funds would be used to help for pay for cleanup. Another thing that should be noted is that historically railroads have been loath to reveal or detail their oil spill plan response plans. That's in part because of federal deregulation and some preemption of local laws. But what the Washington State bill also does is it goes around that to oil refineries and requires at least some information to be produced, to be given over to the Department of Ecology and therefore to the public about volumes of oil moved and other data. So there was some movement. The needle did move in terms of transparency, in terms of oil transportation by rail safety here in Washington State. But lawyers, experts that I've talked to have strongly suggested it's very difficult to regulate railroads on a local and state level because of federal preemption laws. So, in a sense, you're attempting to thread the needle a little bit on that.
What do you mean by federal preemption laws? How does that work?
Very good question. The issue with federal preemption is that in the research that I've done, and there's very good research on this from, and forgive me for not remembering the professor's name, he's out of the University of Colorado, has written extensively about case law over the years with regard to railroads and the regulation of railroads. Very early on, there was a movement to heavily regulate them. That you know, over the years, that did come to fruition, but kind of essentially went away over the years as there was a movement from essentially the political establishment of the U.S. Probably beginning roughly around the 1980s, perhaps somewhat in the 1990s. But the research shows that there was essentially a deregulation movement across a host of industries, including railroads. And after that, from the legislative aspect, the interpretation by courts has been, generally speaking, friendly to federal preemption. Which basically says that the federal government, through, for example, the Federal Railroad Administration and the Pipeline Hazardous Materials, and I'm forgive me for not getting the exact name of that agency, essentially is saying that the federal agencies will be the ones who regulate railroads. And so it's very difficult for state agencies, local agencies, to pass any laws that would affect railroads. Part of this also has to do with interstate commerce laws. Railroads are considered common carriers and are required to carry commodities of various commodities. And so that's really kind of been the history here, is one of deregulation. My sense is there's been a shift. And I don't know exactly to what extent, but there has been a shift in that, in light of the safety issues that have risen from accidents involving oil trains. Some, at least, and of course, one being the highest profile is the one in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, in which some 47 people were killed in an explosion involving an oil train. There have been perceptions that have shifted, and even Senator Maria Cantwell, has essentially proposed federal legislation that would stiffen the regulations of railroads and transportation of oil by rail, and there's some question as to whether that has a chance of passing. But you really have seen much more public attention to this, including not only from a grassroots level, but also from a state and federal level.
Where does that leave us now? We've got 1 minute left. I want to give you a chance to give listeners all the links and where they can find your work, Sightline, and all that. This is one of the names of one of the pieces is the Eye of the Energy Storm. And so, where does this leave us at this point? Because this affects everyone. That Lower Columbia River, the estuary, all of the communities that are in that area, and of course it affects Oregon as well. Where does that leave us? Because these communities don't have the resources to handle a major cleanup.
You know, it's tough, and what you're essentially seeing is with the boom in domestic oil production and the fact that it's very difficult to build pipelines, very cost prohibitive to build a pipeline that would go from the Midwest to the West Coast. So what you're essentially seeing is producers are putting this stuff on rails because it's essentially because of the cost. It's cheaper and you can move it. However, this has raised a whole host of issues with safety of the rail cars themselves. There have been lots of information that have come out about a lack of durability of some of these oil train cars.
I beg your pardon, Aaron. This is all the time we have, but we're going to post links on the website. I cannot thank you enough. My guest has been Aaron Corvin, investigative reporter and journalist with The Columbian out of Vancouver. This has been Air Cascadia for Friday, May 22nd, 2015. And Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. KBOO's AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Hunter. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.